Thank you. Thank you. Good evening. My name is Vince Yeo, and I am an alcoholic. And I would like to tell you that I am delighted to be here tonight. And I'd like to thank your committee for inviting me. Well, you didn't invite me. I'd like to thank you for graciously settling for me, which is, I don't know if there's anyone in the room here yet that does not know. I am not Clancy. I am not as articulate as Clancy. I don't have Clancy's sense of humor. I certainly do not have the perception of the disease of alcoholism that Clancy has. But there is one thing that indisputably I am that he is not. I am here. And glad to be here. I spent an interesting day today. I went to the workshops, and I got here last night in time to catch the end of Eve's talk, which was unfortunate. I think Eve Marsh is one of the giants in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm delighted to be here with her this weekend. I'm sorry that I didn't get to hear her whole talk, but I had a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings that ran from Los Angeles through Dallas to Tampa, airplanes that didn't work and flights that got canceled, which unnerves me. I should tell you that I'm nervous about flying on airplanes. I'm a nervous flyer. That's not true. I'm terrified to fly, is what is the truth. I do it anyway because I just am stuck with this hideous life where I have to get on airplanes, which is tough when you don't like to fly. It's not a a nice thing, and I guess it's God's joke. I suppose when I was new, I was one of these people with a monumental ego that always wanted to be a big AA circuit speaker. And I thought how wonderful and glamorous a life that would be. I'm here to tell you, if you aspire to that, the glamour leaves after about the fourth trip. And then it gets to be a lot of weekends away from home, and unfortunately a lot of weekends on airplanes. And so I guess God's saying, well, here it is, Slim. How do you like it now? Anyway, I'm here and I'm glad to be a part of AA, and I'm glad to be sober and free and alive. And I'm glad to be present in an AA meeting in that capacity. I like to remember that, and I like to say it whenever I have the opportunity. And the reason for that is because I have been present in many AA meetings when I was not sober, free, and a happy, willing participant. I have been present in AA meetings for a lot of different reasons. Sometimes the last of which was a desire for sobriety. I have been present in AA meetings when my motivation was not what it should be, ostensibly, to be a good AA member. And I suppose if I have anything to say to you who are new tonight, those of you who sat down real early tonight, first of all, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to tell you that tonight, that's where you are. You are in AA. Period. There's nothing else going on here, no other action. It is Alcoholics Anonymous. It is not aftercare. It is something completely different. It is not psychotherapeutic. It has nothing to do with therapy. AA is the most unscientific thing you will ever participate in. It has no logic. It has no rhyme or reason. It is a spiritual program. And if you're new, that might frighten you. But if it does, that's the way it is. Because that's who and what we are. And I think we owe it to you, if you're new, to tell you that from the gate. Where you are is AA, and it's spiritual, and it's about God, and it's about all the things that you think will drive you crazy. You should know that. Having said all of that, we are delighted you're here. And if you are new or relatively new, I have never met you, but I know a lot about you. I know, for example, that this year you have made a series of bad decisions. Haven't you? true, isn't it? I know that down deep in your soul, regardless of what you're telling us, you are utterly convinced that you are not really alcoholic, that you don't really belong here, and that your case is different. That you are a little like us, but not really like us. And what I want you to know, that the very fact that you feel that way means that you do belong here. That is the requirement for membership here. That's what it takes to belong here. That's what it is. That's what this is all about. You have a disease. You have an illness, the hallmark of which is that it insists to you that you don't have it. That is the overwhelming characteristic of our disease, based on my experience, or so it seems. I know that you... let me begin. I want to tell you about my first AA meeting, which was a long time ago now. It was in November of 1965, and it was in Long Beach, California. And it was in a section of Long Beach, California called the Los Altos section. Now, I want to tell you about the Los Altos section of Long Beach, California. It is a very nice, affluent, upper middle class community. If you were to walk through Los Altos, you would see a lot of affluent, split-level California kinds of houses, all very highly priced, and the people that own those houses are all very seemingly, at least to me, affluent and well-wrapped people. Do you know what I mean? Tightly wrapped folks. I mean, they have, their lives are in order. They are dentists and insurance salesmen, and they're all married to pretty blonde Al-Anon women, you know? What I mean? And they go to the basement of the Presbyterian Church on Friday night for the AA meeting. And they're a stellar group. They're nice people. And they all seem as though they have a drinking problem. And they go to the Presbyterian Church on Friday night. And they no longer have a drinking problem. And their lives go on. And their pretty blonde Al-Anon wives all do needlepoint during the AA meeting. Do you know what I mean? And it all is very nice. If you were to look around on the night that I got there in November of 1965, if you were to look around that room in the basement of that church, if someone were to say to you, pick out the alcoholics here, you wouldn't find any. No recognizable alcoholics in that room. They all look good. If you look closely, you would have picked one out. You would have found me. I look like an alcoholic. I had a torn t-shirt on and a ripped pair of jeans. I had not shaved nor bathed in over a week. And I had just spent the previous 5 days in the Long Beach City Jail due to a series of unfortunate circumstances that were not my fault. The Long Beach Police Department happens to be fascist. And they had abused my civil rights on a regular basis, that being the latest. And I like to remember the reason I ended up in the basement of that church. And if you're new and you think that you're not properly motivated to be here, I have grand news for you. We do not grade you on your motivation here. Isn't that good news? If we did, this would be a smaller meeting. And you'd have a different speaker, let me tell you. I ended up in the basement of that church for one reason. I had no job, no car, no money, and no place to live. And that was the only place I knew of where I could sit down and not be arrested. That's why I was there. And I sat in the back of the room where most new people sit in AA. Seldom do they get up too close. There's a, I suppose, a sense that if you don't have it, you might catch it. You know what I mean? I sat in the back. And I should tell you from the outset that I am Irish and I am Catholic. And I'm from New Jersey, and I have great difficulty with people from Texas. I don't know why. I guess the chemistry is bad or something, but we don't seem to hit it off. All my life, I've been in trouble with Texans. And I sat in the back of that room next to a guy who was about 6'5", and he had on cowboy boots, and he had a 10-gallon hat in his lap, and his name was Tex. And Tex... wasn't sober very long himself. He was at what I like to think of as the evangelical stage of sobriety. You know what I mean? Like somewhere in the middle of his third month or so. And Tex wanted to hip me. And he told me, he said, "Boy, I'm going to hip you." You know, and I remember thinking, you know, Jesus. You know, why don't you go hip somebody else, Tex? You know, I'd give it a break. I'd really just as soon you not hip me. But he wasn't having any of that. He was going to help me anyway. And the first thing he did is he repeated to me in rapid succession all of the AA cliches, one after another. And they are dreary, aren't they? If you know, I mean, if you're new and you're here to be inspired, and there's some jerk with his arm around you telling you things like, "Easy does it." And I would think, you know, easy does what? I mean, and he finally put his arm around my shoulder and he said, "Keep it simple." And I thought, "I'll bet you do, Tex." I have no quarrel with that. And he put a handful of pamphlets in my lap. We have a pamphlet for everyone here. We have your case covered, believe me. Whoever you have, or whatever you've done, we can cover your case in a pamphlet. And on top of the pamphlets was the card with the 20 questions on it that the folks at the medical school at Johns Hopkins have devised. In their infinite wisdom, they can determine how alcoholic you are by the way you answer these questions. I can tell you this, if you're new and you don't want to belong here, find a way to answer no to these questions. Because the more yes answers you have as you go down, the more alcoholic you become. It's really a losing proposition, at least according to Johns Hopkins. And I think the criteria is if you answer one question yes, you may have a drinking problem. If you answer two yes, you definitely have a drinking problem. And if you answer three yes, you're an alcoholic. I answered 19 yes. I did answer no to the question, "Do you seek lower companions?" Yeah. You know, I'll tell you, I could not find any. Or I would have answered yes to that, I suppose. And the meeting began, and they began that meeting just precisely almost how we began here tonight, and they begin all meetings in Southern California that way anyway, and I suppose out here now. They read that portion from our book that constitutes our recovery program. They read chapter 5, how it works. And I don't know about you, but I sat in that room and I listened to what was read. I didn't hear anything new. Nothing new there to me. I'm the end product of 8 years of Dominican nuns and 4 years of Jesuit priests. And there's not much new there to me. What's new about all that? I had lived within the framework of that ethic all my life. I know all about these principles. They're not new. We call them by different names. You talk about searching and fearless moral inventory as if it is a new idea. It's not a new idea. Where I come from, we have another name. We call that examination of conscience. You talk about admitting to God and to another human being the exact nature of your wrongs. I did that every Saturday afternoon from the time I was 7 years old, probably through the time I was about 16. And I was familiar with that, and that was fine. There's nothing wrong with that, I suppose. It certainly preserves your position in any life that may come hereafter. But it doesn't have anything to do with the way that I drink alcohol. I know that. So what I did, subconsciously, I didn't reason all of this out in the basement of that Presbyterian church. But what I did subconsciously is I dismissed those things. I said to myself, my case is different. That will not work for me. Sat through the meeting. It was a good meeting. It was several people participated. Dentists, insurance salesmen, nice people. They talked about having a drinking problem, coming to the Los Altos meeting, and they didn't have a drinking problem anymore. They had a you know, it was just wonderful. Their lives get put back together. One guy in particular, he got 6 months prior to that evening while he got drunk, he blew the mortgage payment on his house. Then he found you wonderful people in this splendid program. And his life was just marvelous. And I turned to Tex. I said, where do you send the more difficult cases? Because I don't know what's wrong with him, but there's something much more wrong with me. And he said, shut up, or something equally as appropriate. And if I had any doubts as to whether I belonged there or not, they were cured at the end of that meeting when they had a series of what we refer to in California as birthday parties, their anniversaries. Only in California, what we do is we sing happy birthday to them, and we present them with cakes, with candles on them, like you would. Isn't it dismal? It really is kind of dreary, isn't it? It sounds like some pop psychology or cheap psychotherapy. And I watched a series of these. You know, you have a room full of middle-aged people singing happy birthday to some jackass who's gone a year without taking a drink, and they give him a cake, and he blows the candle out on it. I mean, it really is smacks of a mental institution, doesn't it? Like something you would do before dance therapy or right after you were down working on your wallet, you know. And they had a series of these imbecilic birthday parties, I recall. And the last one was for a gal who was about 110, and she'd been sober forever. They had a bonfire on top of this goddamn cake. And she got up and started to blow the candles out, and it really seemed as though the pulmonary disease would get her before she got them out. She got them out. She got up here and she said her name was Phoebe and she was an alcoholic. And then she said something about, did I want what she had? And the answer was clearly no. Not really. That was my first AA meeting. And I suppose it is safe to assume that I did not have a spiritual awakening. I did not grasp the essence of our program, I can tell you that. I'll tell you what I did, though, and I think it's quite interesting if you're new. I stayed sober. I drank no alcohol. I used no mood-altering chemicals whatsoever. I did it on the natch for 3.5 years. And during that period of time, I did everything there was to do in AA. I participated in every facet of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in AA meetings nightly. I joined committees, the General Service Committee. I was active in my group. I emptied ashtrays. I set up chairs. I cleaned cups. I did everything there was to do in AA, except one thing. I never took these steps. And as a result, my alcoholism got worse. It got worse while I was present, active, and involved in Alcoholics Anonymous on a nightly basis. Now, and you know what? I'll tell you the sad, you know what really the bad thing about that? And there are people here tonight who can identify with this, I know, because they're in every meeting. I knew it was getting worse. I was aware of it. And there are people here tonight in that boat. And the way that you know it's getting worse is you watch other people around you who are getting better. They're getting better, and they are clearly getting better. There is no doubt about that they're getting better. They have, something happens to somebody who gets better here, doesn't it? You can see it on them. They wear it. Recovery from alcoholism is visually perceptible. People have something happening up here in their eyes. They have a sense about them. They have purpose and direction, and they're going somewhere. And their conversation is filled with things that make me crazy. They talk sincerely about developing a relationship with a higher power, and they mean it. They even talk, they talk about and actually do pay the money back. They help others for free and for fun. No price tag. And I watched that happen to people, and it would seem to me, I would sit in AA meeting after AA meeting, and I'd watch somebody who came in here long after I had been here, and something went boom. It would happen to them. You could see it happen right before your eyes. You could see them. They're getting better. They have purpose, and they have direction, and they're going somewhere, and I used to think, my God, when does this happen to me? When does that happen to me? I used to think they had secret meetings somewhere where they shared the real secret. You know what I mean? It could not possibly be this. And pretty soon, I came here with a set of resentments. Every alcoholic does. I don't know anyone that didn't. But I developed a whole new set. And you know who they were? The people who were getting better in AA. I began to detest them because they got better and I didn't. Now, unfortunately, it got real confusing because my life started to look better, oddly enough. I mean, good things happened to me on the outside. I was 24 years old. I have an excellent education, and I come from a marvelous family. Let me tell you about that family a little bit, because there's a lot of confusion in AA today. And what I hear is, and may not be the intention of the people who say it, but I hear a lot of people who somehow I get the feeling that they feel that hating their parents can somehow make them whole. You know, and it just makes me crazy. I have a tremendous, if you're new, I have some news for you you're not going to like. And that is this. Now, I discovered it when I finally got around years later to taking that searching and fearless moral inventory. You know what that is? My life is my fault. Isn't that a hell of a thing? I mean, I wish it weren't. But it is. And when you write that inventory, that's what you're going to find out if you do it right. Your life's your fault. Now, I have this family. It's a huge Irish Catholic family in the East, and they're wonderful people. They are, I mean, they love each other. They care about each other. My mother was 45 and my father was 50 when I was born, and I have four older sisters, the youngest being 11 years older than me. They're a sprawling, huge Irish Catholic family with a, and everybody loves each other. They're all married to the same spouse. All of their children have gone through professional school. There aren't any alcoholics. They're all social drinkers. They're wonderful. They loved me all of my life. They loved me, and I knew they loved me. They cared about me to see that I had the very best. Not only that, they had money. I have a classic Roman Catholic education. I went through the very best of schools. I was a terrible behavior problem. I was always in trouble, but always a good student. I went right through an Ivy League university. I have an undergraduate degree in biochemistry from an Ivy League school, all as the result of the love and the care and the nurturing that I got from that family and the Roman Catholic Church. And if you're new, I'm going to take something else away from you. It's not the Catholic Church's fault. Or anybody else's fault. Let me tell you about my experience. You know what my experience is with the Roman Catholic Church? I was exposed to a group of clergy who loved me, cared for me, and saw to it that I was educated in spite of myself. That's my experience. It's not their fault. Now, in 1965, when I came to that AA meeting, I had what I did was, let me tell you, I ran away from school. My uncle was my guardian, who was a politician in the East, and my parents died when I was 12, within 1 week of each other, which was a kind of a traumatic thing for a kid. And I went to live with this bachelor uncle, who was mayor of a large city in the East, and he was the quintessential classic Irish bachelor politician, okay? He had never married, he went to Mass daily, and he had all of the things that an Irish politician has, except he was 65 and I was 12. And I went to live with him. We had a communications problem. We had dinner every night in this, Dan knows where I'm talking about, Hamilton Park, and where he lived. That's right, the mansion. And we had dinner at this dining room table with a housekeeper that served us, he at one end and me at the other, dressed in a coat and tie, because he insisted on that. And he would talk to me like I was 50. And the tragedy is, I would answer him like I was 50. You know what I mean? So we had a communications problem. But he loved me. I mean, he loved me. He wanted the very best for me. He saw to it that I had the very best. He never understood me, but he loved me. And so he insisted, I wanted to go to the University of Notre Dame. I was a kid. If you were a kid and you grew up as an Irish Catholic in the East, I mean, that's where the magic was. It was at Notre Dame. And that's where I wanted to go to school. But he had decided, he had great plans for me. He thought big things were going to happen for me. And he insisted that I go to an Ivy League school. Well, I went to three of them. I got thrown out of two of them. But I ended up getting through one, just barely. And I got through it, and I got my degree. But before I got my degree, in my senior year, I shook my fist at him in rebellion, and I showed him real good. I fixed him good. I ran away from school. I showed him. And I joined the Navy, which was an intelligent, mature thing to do, wasn't it? And I joined the Navy as an enlisted man, because that's where they, college dropouts are enlisted men in the Navy. They don't commission them. And I was going to be a physician. Hopefully I was going to go to medical school, so I had all of this scientific undergraduate work, and they made me a hospital corpsman in the Navy. They made me, you know what I do in life well is I take written tests well. If life was a written test, I don't think I would be here tonight. I do well at written tests. I do well, and if you can put me in a controlled environment where I'm not free and give me a lot of tests, I'm a superstar. I really am. I mean, I function well in that kind of environment. So what they do with you in the Navy, the first thing they do with you is they give you a bunch of tests. And I did, they said, what do you want to do, kid? First of all, we'd like to have you become an electronics technician and a nuclear weapons man. I said, not really. Thank you, but no. I'm going to be a physician. I'm going to go to medical school. And they said, well, in that case, we'll make you a hospital corpsman. So they sent me to hospital corps school in the Navy. Now, I got A's, and I graduated number one. And they said to me, we're going to send you to a more advanced school where they train hospital corpsmen that function on destroyers that don't have doctors. And it's called independent duty school. And so they sent me to that school for a year and a half. And you know what? I graduated number one. And then they said, hey, we want to send you to another school, medical administration school, where you can learn medical administration, another two-year school. And they sent me to that school, and I graduated number one, and they made me an ensign. And I was a commissioned officer in the United States Navy, and I had done nothing for 4 years except go to school. No duty. And then the axe fell. They sent me to duty. Now, here's where trouble started. First of all, they sent me to the Marine Corps, which was a hell of a thing. I didn't bargain for the Marine Corps. They sent me to Okinawa, to the 3rd Marine Division and the 5th Marine. You see, the Navy provides the Marine Corps' medical department. And I moved into an officer's club in the northern end of Okinawa, where I lived. And when I say I live there, I live there. I almost never left there. But the officer's club had something quite interesting. They had a bar. And I discovered the answer to living in the officer's club on Camp Schwab in Okinawa. And I can tell you where it is if you don't know. It's in the cocktail lounge. And it's Haig and Haig Pinch. And it goes for 60 cents a shot in those days. And I met a guy there. He was a lieutenant commander, and he was a surgeon at a Temple University. And he and I became spiritual brothers. This guy and I lived in the officers' club bar. As a matter of fact, we began to develop a bad reputation with the regimental commander in the Marine Corps because we were always drunk. Always drunk. And he felt that we should no longer be around patients. So he relieved us of our duty. And we finished our naval careers in charge of venereal disease control on the island of Okinawa, which is a terrible way, to unceremonious way to end your medical and naval career, isn't it? excuse me. Anyway, I got out of the Navy coming back from the United States, and I ended up in that AA meeting. I went back to school, and I got my degree. And I ended up in California in late 1964. And in 1965, I ended up in that AA meeting. I had to tell you all of that so I can get to where I'm going. And I ended up in that AA meeting that I explained to you a while ago. And something happened in early 1966 in civilian medicine. A new profession opened up. It was called the Physician's Assistant or Physician's Associate Program. And they were looking for guys like me who had all of this extensive military medical training. We were the charter members of that profession. As a matter of fact, in the summer of 1966, I was the very first licensed PA in the state of California, third licensed PA in the state of California, excuse me. And I went to work in the best job in Los Angeles that a PA could go into. What this was is they took people like us and they put us in emergency rooms where to relieve physicians to go practice the real medicine. We did the primary medicine in the emergency room. We saw the patients and evaluated them and prescribed medicine. Did all, sutured the laceration, did everything that a physician does in an emergency room, except we were not MDs. And there are PAs doing that still, and they're very good. You don't be disarmed if you have to go to the emergency room tonight. But they are well-trained, and they do it. I don't anymore, which ought to make you feel good, but there are those that do, and they're well-trained, and they're very competent. I went to work in Los Angeles with my newfound sobriety in AA in an emergency room in the industrial complex, and I worked nights. And I worked 12 hours a night, and it was rewarding in every way. I mean, I was young, and I was in on the ground floor of a new profession. They paid me a lot of money, and it was spiritually, emotionally rewarding. It was in every way, and I was on a roll. I mean, I had this newfound sobriety. I met a beautiful girl, the daughter of a longtime AA member. And she was gorgeous, and we fell in love, and bright and witty, and she went to Al-Anon, and I was in AA. We were that grand young AA couple. You know them, you've met them. I mean, he has a great job, she's in Al-Anon, they're just swell. I mean, grand things are going to happen to them, you know what I mean? Didn't work out that way. Because I would go into this emergency room. Now, I never took these steps. There was no spiritual program in my life. And I'd go into this emergency room at night. And pretty soon, things would happen to me inside that you and I know about. Feelings of overwhelming loneliness. You know about that? Being lonely in a room full of people that love you. Inadequacy. The overall positive notion that I'm not up to the task. That I'm way over my head. That I'm not qualified. And I'm frightened. And I'm alone. And it's a vague kind of fear. The kind you can't tell people about. Do you understand that? The kind that is really inexplicable. You can't tell people about it because they look at you like you're nuts. How do you tell people? I'm afraid. And they say to you, what are you afraid of? And you say, well, beats the hell out of me, but I'm afraid. You know, you can't do that to people. They don't. But you know what I'm talking about. You know about it. And I'd go into that emergency room and I would have these kinds of things going on, and this marriage was in bad shape already because I was inadequate and she was inadequate, and I began to get terribly depressed. Now, I don't have a program, but I have an excellent medical education, so I know how to take care of depression. I used Excedrin. 15 milligram spantules work best, and by the time I was through with those, I was taking 8 or 9 a day. Now, anyone here that knows anything about amphetamine abuse will understand. That has you zipping right along. Let me tell you. Whatever you do it in a hurry. But the problem with that is, along about the 5th or 6th day when you have not slept nor eaten, your hair stands right up on end like that. I'll tell you. And your eyes dilate out over here, and you show up in the emergency room to help the sick, you know. And it looks bad. The guy you're relieving never wants to go home. You know what I mean? But there's an answer to that. Medical science, thank God for medical science, it has an answer. And the answer is a drug called Demerol, which is a narcotic. It's an opiate. Oh, and incidentally, I heard a lot of talk today about drugs and alcohol, and there's a difference between alcoholics and narcotic addicts. It's a different kind of addiction. Don't let anyone tell you that it's the same addiction. It's not. Narcotics come from opium. Opiates are addictive. I mean, they're addictive. They're drugs like morphine and heroin and Dilaudid and Demerol, and they all come from the same family. They come from opium, and they're addictive, and they are addictive for everybody. You don't even need an addictive personality to get hooked on heroin. You need a syringe and a needle. And if you inject it intravenously, you become addicted. Everybody does. That is not true with alcohol. 9 out of 10 people who drink alcohol do it with impunity. They never end up here. They are what is known as social drinkers. Social, do you know who they are? Social drinkers are people who do things that I don't, my family are social drinkers. They do things like, you know what they say? Social drinkers say, no more for me. You know, I have to drive. You know, they say, hey, no more. My wife's waiting dinner. I said I'd be home. Or the best, my personal favorite. I have to admit I stole it from Gene Duffy yet. But my personal favorite is, let's eat. I didn't drink that way. That's what social drinkers do. And 9 out of 10 people who drink socially, that's what they do. And I have to remember why I drank alcohol. It became real clear to me. I knew it all along. I drank alcohol to be like you. I drank alcohol to fit in, to be a part of, to participate. I drank alcohol all of my life to feel like you, look like you felt. That's why I drank alcohol. When I injected Demerol in an emergency room, back in the physician's room, I did it for another reason. You know what that was? I wanted to drop out. I wanted to leave. And it was a totally different kind of addiction. Now, many in Alcoholics Anonymous, including me, are both. Are both. I never took any drug whatsoever until long after I had come to Alcoholics Anonymous. So my primary problem is alcoholism. And I used drugs later on because I learned a great deal in AA. You know what I learned? I couldn't drink. That's what I learned here. And so I got in trouble with the Demerol, because the funny thing about Demerol is a controlled substance. Let me tell you what that means. That means people care about what happens to Demerol. I mean, they really get upset when the dope is gone out of the drawer in the emergency room. And they, people like administrators and, really get crazy when the Demerol, they measure Demerol vials, you know. And I'll tell you who the people are that get the most upset. They are the people on the State Narcotics Board in California. They get really upset. And they came into that emergency room and found all this Demerol gone, and they placed me under arrest like a common criminal, like some kind of a drug addict. You know what I mean? That's the way they treated me. They took me to the Los Angeles County Jail and booked me through there and charged me with a felony appropriating narcotics for my own use. Now, that was subsequently reduced to a misdemeanor, and I didn't have to go to jail, but I had my medical license revoked, as well it should be. And I ended up, and incidentally, it's interesting to note that I was immediately cut off from any Demerol, which was a, but I'll tell you what, that was depressing. But I didn't go through cold sweats or, you know, I didn't have to be locked in a cell. I didn't have to, later on I withdrew from alcohol and it was much worse, let me tell you. Because I spent the summer of 1972 with this young lady who I was married to. We spent the summer of 1972 living in an apartment by the airport in Englewood, California. And I spent July and August of that year drinking 1/2 gallon of vodka a day. And she watched. And all of the things that happen to you when you drink 1/2 gallon of vodka a day happened to me. And once again, I don't think that you have to worry about diagnoses when you drink 1/2 gallon of vodka a day. You can throw out all the psychobabble. You know, you don't have to worry about denial. You drink 1/2 gallon of vodka a day, and the jury is in, let me tell you. Because it's axiomatic what will happen to you if you drink 1/2 gallon of vodka a day. You don't sleep. You don't eat. You're never asleep and you're never awake, though. Isn't that funny? You're never drunk and you're never sober. You don't eat. And if you're like me, you lose 30 pounds in July and August of 1972. And it's a nightmarish existence. You're in and out of blackouts all the time. You don't know what's real and what isn't real. And pretty soon, in the beginning of September, this girl's family came and they pulled her out of that apartment and left just me there. And with some money, I don't know how much, but enough to get over to that liquor store several more times and buy 1/2 gallon and bring it back to that apartment. And I don't know how many days that happened, but they were several. And I came out of a blackout in Newport Beach. And I don't remember how I got there, except it was in mid-September 1972, and the temperature was about 110, and I had on a 3-piece wool suit and a white shirt and a tie. And I had a suitcase with me with some clothes in it, and I was sitting on a bench on the Balboa Peninsula in Newport Beach, and I was going through the ads of the Orange County newspaper looking for a job. I became cognizant of where I was in that condition. I don't remember how I got there, but clearly I must have known I needed a job, and I was right. And I went through the ads of that newspaper, and I found a job that day, too. I found a job as an apprentice embalmer for a mortician in Costa Mesa, California, which is a dreadful job if you're new. Don't do that. It's a, boy, I'll tell you, that's a, not a good idea. The job paid $85 a week, and a fringe benefit was an apartment that was over the casket room in the back of the mortuary. So it was, you know, have you ever in the morning walked through a casket room with a hangover? My, geez, it'll set you free, I'll tell you. It just, boy, that's bad news. And I worked for this guy for about, and the guy, I'll tell you, people don't believe it, the guy was just awful. It was your worst nightmare. It was, he was a ghoul, and he had a crippled leg, and he drug his leg when he walked. Christ. And it was just like something, you couldn't make this up, I'll tell you. It was awful. And I didn't like him, and he didn't like me. And I was there about 5 days, and I got drunk, and I stole his hearse, is what I did. And on September the 20th, 1972, I came out of yet one more blackout, driving the wrong way on Pacific Coast Highway in Newport Beach with a young lady next to me who I did not recall meeting, incidentally, who was screaming hysterically at the top of her lungs. And I remember thinking, you know, Jesus, I really tend to get involved with neurotic women. You know, if you really stop and think about it, I really do. And I told this gal that, too. I said, you know, you really overreact. I'll tell you. Because she continued to scream even after I got this thing going the right way. And that was September the 20th, 1972. And oddly enough, I have not had a drink of alcohol, nor have I used any mood-altering chemical whatsoever from that day to this. And that's, well, first of all, it's very good news if you're me. But what's significant about that is not so much that fact. Because I knew that you could go long periods of time without drinking alcohol. But if you could have somehow foretold my future, it would have been quite remarkable. If you could have materialized in the back of that hearse, and if you could have said to me, do you really know what's going to happen to you? It's going to be incredible. I mean, tomorrow you're going to go back to AA. But that's not a big deal. You've been there before. But what's really going to happen to you is amazing. First of all, good things on the outside are not going to happen. Your life's not going to come together at all. It's going to be terrible. And as a result of that, you know what's going to happen to you? You're going to become desperate. You're going to become so desperate that you can't believe it. And as a result of that desperation, you are going to become willing to do things and take actions that you do not believe in. And as a result of those actions, you're going to get recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I would not have believed that. But I'll tell you, I got the guy's hearse back to him, and he was upset. He was in that apartment over the casket room, and he was throwing my clothes out the window, piece by piece. And all of a sudden, it was 6 a.m., and all of my clothes were strewn all over this blacktop parking lot of this mortuary in Costa Mesa, California. I had no job, no car, no money, and no place to live. I don't know about you, but every time I get in that kind of shape, I go to AA. So that's what I do. So that's nothing to applaud, let me tell you. I packed up, I got all of my clothes and put them in a cardboard box, and I found myself at the Costa Mesa Alano Club, which is not where the elite meet, let me tell you. It is a grim, dreary AA club in Costa Mesa, California. I walked into that club and I set this box on the floor and I sat at the coffee bar and I had a cup of coffee, trying to figure out my next move, I suppose. They had an AA meeting there that noon, and I went to that meeting, and I'd be delighted to tell you that I had a spiritual awakening, but that's not so. It was a terrible meeting. It was a dreary noontime Alano Club AA meeting with a long table, a long white table, with about eight Texans sitting at that table, repeating to each other the same Pavlovian repetitive crap about if you just put the plug in the jug, you know, fundamental, superficial, cliched nonsense. I sat through it because I had nowhere else to go. And the meeting ended, and I sat at the coffee bar, had another cup of coffee, had another meeting there that night, went to that meeting. My social calendar was not pressing. I could fit it in. And the manager of the club let me sleep on the sofa there that night. And the next day I got up and I got in a gin rummy game with some ladies there. And I won $25, I think. And I went out and I rented a room on Federal Avenue in Costa Mesa for $11 a week. And this room is precisely what you would imagine an $11 a week room to be like. You think about it, you'll be correct. It's they are rather generic, aren't they? $11 a week rooms are... And I moved in there, and I remember thinking, my God, I don't think I can live in a place like this for more than a couple weeks. And clearly, I'll have to be here for some amount of time. I mean, I have nothing. There's no family left willing to talk to me. There's nothing left. I mean, there's nowhere to go. I got to live in this $11 a week room, and I don't think I can live in a hovel like this for 3 weeks. 2 years later, when I moved out of that room, didn't look that bad. A funny thing happened. I spent the first 2 years of my sobriety living in Newport Beach. And during that period of time, if you would have asked me at any given moment, how is your life? I would have told you, my God, it's abominable. My life is terrible. I'm all through. I'm 31 years old and I'm finished. I'm unemployable. My license is gone. The only thing I'm educated to do, I can't do. I'm incompetent. I'm inept. I'm one of those college people that can't do anything. You know what I mean? I lost a job as a gas station attendant for being incompetent. Fired by some jackass from Texas. True. I lost a job as a $1.87 an hour drill press operator. Do you know how difficult that is? You can't be a bad drill press operator. This was in a machine shop on Placentia Avenue in Costa. I'll never forget it. It was a stone building, and I got this job for $1.87 an hour. And I walked into there, and what I did was I sat on a stool, and they wheeled up this cart with all of these copper plates in it. And the job, you took a copper plate, and you put it under the drill. Then you pulled the handle, and the drill came down and put a hole in the copper plate. You then picked up the copper plate, and you put it in this bucket. That was the job. I managed to put the hole in the wrong place in about 800 of these copper plates one day. And the foreman came up to me, who was originally from right outside of Dallas. He was. That's true. And said to me, we had this conversation. I can see it today. Like it was the most bizarre conversation. He said to me, boy, I got to let you go. He said, I'm sorry too, son. He says, because you're a real trier. He says, you're trying hard. He says, but you're just not quite bright enough to do this kind of work. You know, I went out of my mind. I said, you moron, I went to Cornell. And you know, you should never do that with those. I'll tell you, you know, they're country slick. They get you, you know. And he looked me right in the eye and he said, well, I'll tell you what, son, you ought to go back and take the course in drill press operating. I lost my job. And I walked out of that factory in the pouring rain. It was in February of 1973. And I walked back to this dismal $11 a week room that I lived in. And I got soaking wet. And I had bronchitis. And I was coughing. And I thought, Jesus, I don't have any medical insurance. I'm going to get sick. I can't make a living. I mean, if you lose a job as a $1.87 an hour drill press operator, you know, you really are in trouble. I was 31 years old. I thought they locked people like me up in places like Patton and Camarillo and where they call it custodial care. And it might sound funny 17 years later. It wasn't funny in February of 1973. And I went back to that terrible room, and some mail had caught up with me. I'll never forget. One was a letter from upstate New York from a physician inviting me to join a committee for my class reunion at college. And I remember reading this letter, and the total incongruity of my life was in front of my eyes. It was, how did this happen to me? How could I have possibly ended up here? What happened? Where did it all come from? I had gone through a period of my life, and I remember it so well. And there are many of you here, I'm sure, that have experienced this. When you were a kid and you held such promise, your life held such promise. Do you remember that? When you were the youngest in achieving things? I mean, I skipped the sixth grade and went to the seventh grade, and I was the youngest kid in the seventh grade. I was the youngest kid in my graduating class from high school. And I remember I was the youngest kid ever nominated for an award, an oratorical and American Legion Leadership Award that was given to this outstanding student. I was the youngest kid nominated. I didn't get it. Peter Kalushjian got it. Peter Kalushjian. Peter Kalushjian was a... anyone that would follow Peter Kalushjian anywhere... He was, his mother made him wear earmuffs in the summer. Do you know what I mean? And he always had colds. Peter's nose always ran all the way down his face. And that was Peter Kalushjian. He won the award. But a time came, and maybe I became aware of it that day standing in that crummy room in Costa Mesa, that I was no longer the youngest at anything. I was now the oldest. I was the oldest of my peers, who did not have any stability in their life, who had no character, no track record, no career, no nothing. And I was to experience many more instances where I now became the oldest, only in such a negative way. And I remember thinking about this letter from Dr. Medall from Syracuse. How do I answer the doctor? What do you say to him? Can't make it this year, doctor. Just lost my job as a drill press operator. I mean, you know. And that night I went to the meeting in Newport, on the Newport Peninsula. It was a big speaker meeting in the Ebel Club down there. It was a wonderful, wonderful AA meeting. They were just great people there. They treated me with love and kindness, and they were wealthy people. That was depressing. They tied their yachts up outside, and they would come into the meeting, and I would be confronted with that. That would depress me. But it was a great meeting, and they were great people. And that night, the speaker was, Eve will remember this guy. His name was Norm Alpe. And he may have been the best speaker in the history of AA. Sorry, Clancy, don't get this tape. he wasn't Clancy. He was second. Eve remembers, he was a magnificent man. He was an alcoholic. He gave the quintessential AA talk. This guy got up and he told you his story. And that's all he ever did. He just told you his story. And his talk was, you could give it word for word after you hear him about four times. But the funny thing about it is, it didn't matter that you knew precisely what he was going to say, because you lived it with him every time. He had that special gift where he touched your soul with his talk. And I listened to Norm talk that night. And even he did not move me on that night. I was just absolutely consumed with despair. And I went back to that $11 a week room, and the guy giving me a ride back had to let me off at the bottom of the hill. And I had to walk up the hill, and I got soaking wet for the second time that day. And I was sure I was going to get pneumonia. And I went back into that crummy room with the light bulb from the ceiling. And I looked at my life, and it was just, I broke down, I cried, I felt terrible. I mean, I just saw no hope. And I was so desperate and so consumed with despair that I did something out of abject desperation that is so stupid, I can't believe I ever did it. It's the most ridiculous thing I ever did. I got on my knees beside the bed, and I said a prayer. And it was simple, and it was not sophisticated. It was, God, please help me, because I'm afraid, and I'm alone, and I don't think I can make it anymore. My recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous began that night. That is the prescription. If you're new, you now know the secret in AA. And the great thing about that is, It is not necessary that you believe in that God or have any faith in that prayer. The only thing we demand you do here is take the action. Just do it. We don't care what you believe here. If you're new, what you believe is worthless. Everything you know is invalid. And if you're willing to do what we suggest and just take the action, that is called surrender in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I took that action and I asked for help. Now, I didn't get any help, as near as I could tell. Not for a long time, as near as I could tell, based on my estimation of what help should be, because life went on. And I went back over to that crummy Alano Club the next day, out of work one more time, only now I got a cold. And there was a guy that hung around that Alano Club. He was in the floor covering business. His name was Clarence. Clarence was a one-man operation, you know what I mean? He'd run down to the places on Balboa Island and he'd sell them floor covering. He'd go to the store and he'd buy it, then he'd run down and put it in, you know? That's the way Clarence... And Clarence was from Texas, too, incidentally. But he was about 11 years sober. And he said to me, how would you like a job? I'll pay you $10 a day and I'll provide your meals. And you can be my gopher. You go for the tools and go for the carpet and help carry it. He said, that's all you need to do. I'll pay you $10 a day and provide your meals. You can't screw this up, he said. And it sounded like a heck of a deal to me. So I went to work for Clarence. And I was his gopher. And I'm here to tell you, I worked for Clarence for about 14 months. He paid me $10 a day. He provided my meals. And I was living like the president of General Motors. I mean, I had a low overhead. $11 a week, you know. And I remember about 3 months into that, we were into the spring of 1973. And a funny thing happened to me. I continued to say this prayer every night. And pretty soon, without noticing it, I began to add something to it. I began to say, thank you. And that made me crazy when I thought about it. So I had nothing to be grateful for. I mean, if you had my life, what would you be grateful for? But I found myself one day down in Balboa Island in May of 1973, and the sun was out, and it was a beautiful day that only we can get in Southern California. Sorry, Floridians. But it was that golden, golden Southern California day in May when the sun was out and all was right with the world. And I found myself just having gotten paid from Clarence, and I had about $15 in my pocket, and I was walking down Balboa Island, and I bought a frozen banana, and I was eating this frozen banana walking down toward the ferry, and something occurred to me that I felt very good. And I really didn't know why. The feeling scared me at first, because I thought, why should I feel good? And it occurred to me why. Because I didn't have to drink, and I didn't have to use anything, and I was just going to be okay. That's as close to a spiritual experience as I've ever had in AA, but it's a pretty darn good one for me. And life went on, and I began to acquire some material possessions working for Clarence. I got a 1964 red Chevrolet convertible with no brakes in the hole in the top. And I used to drive that to the E-Bell Club on Thursday night, and I'd pull that into the parking lot, and everyone would get in their Mercedes and drive it to the other side of the lot. They were always asking me questions like, do you have insurance on that car? You know, that was a big question. Why would I have insurance? I hadn't had a driver's license in 3 years. You know, it's a redundancy. And time went by. And pretty soon my second birthday had come in AA. I was sober 2 years in AA. And I was saying this prayer. But I knew I needed help of a more practical nature. The kind of help that you get from a sponsor. Now, I don't recommend that you go 2 years without a sponsor if you're new. But that's what I did. And the reason I did that, the reason, you want to know why I put it off? Because I knew who the sponsor had to be. And I did not want to make this move. Because I didn't like this guy. This guy was somebody I didn't like at all. He was arrogant. And he was self-serving. And he was cruel to people, sometimes needlessly, as near as I could tell. And he was terribly glib. And he had all of these wise remarks that he made to new people. And I thought new people needed love. And he was cruel. There's something about this guy that was undeniable. Undeniable. He apparently had an amazing capacity for helping losers in Alcoholics Anonymous. This guy was the patron saint of the hopeless cases. I'm going to tell you. Because people would go to this guy and they would ask him to be their sponsor. And he would say to them, if you take my direction, I will be your sponsor. And they would kind of, we watched them in Orange County, the dregs of the earth, you know, the worst hopeless cases in AA would go to this guy. They'd get him for a sponsor and they'd join his fascist AA group on the west side of LA. And they would do things that were seemingly unrelated to AA, but they would get better. Their lives would come back. And I saw this and I knew that somehow in the back of my mind, there was some kind of hope for me there. And I watched person after person go up there. One guy that pushed me over the edge, I'll never forget him. His name was a biker. His name was Manchester Red, okay? Manchester Red had no redeeming social value. I mean, he was always drunk. He had all his teeth kicked in and a matted, filthy beard. And he never bathed. And he always had a bottle of Canadian Club in his pocket, you know, in the meetings. He always wanted to kill somebody in the meeting. You know what I mean? Just, you were in a meeting with Red, you thought, oh my God, you know, why am I here? Red dropped out of sight. Word was that he got this guy for a sponsor. And he joined his AA group. We didn't see him. And about 6 months later, somebody was sitting in a meeting in Newport Beach, and somebody said, hey, look in the back of the room. There's Red. And I looked in the back, and I didn't see Red. I said, where? He's not back there. I said, oh, look at him. There he is. And I looked closely, and there he was. Except Red looked different. He had his hair cut. He was clean shaven. All his dental work was done. He had on a pair of gray slacks and a navy blue blazer and penny loafers. He did. Sitting in the back of the room, like a gentleman, cold sober. And they called him up to share. And Red came to the podium. And he said 6 months prior to that evening why he made his first child support payment in 10 years. And next month he was going to vote in the presidential election for the Republican, you know, right. So Red pushed me over the edge. I thought, you know, so I called this guy up and I asked him if he'd help me. He said, well, I'll tell you what, you come up and see me. And he ran this mission on Skid Row in Los Angeles. And he said, you drive up here and see me and we'll talk about it. And so I went up there and I visited with this guy. And I asked him to help me. And I'll never forget what he said. And if you are new or relatively new in AA, I hope that you are fortunate enough to have somebody say something like this to you. He said to me, yes, I will help you on one condition. And that is this, that you are willing to accept the simple proposition that your very best judgment about your life is terrible. And that my judgment about your life is infinitely better than yours. Now, he didn't say his judgment about his life. He said his judgment about my life. Now, I'm here to tell you that I am grateful that I was desperate enough that day to make that unholy pact with the devil. Because I agreed to do what this guy said. And he said, the first thing I want you to do, he says, I want you to move in here to this mission and live here. I said, whoa, 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 whoa. You misunderstand. I'm looking for upward mobility. You know, I really don't want to move into a mission on Skid Row in L.A. And he said, well, do you have a better idea? And I thought for a moment, and I said, you know, I really don't. And he said, I want you to live here. And here's what I want you to do. I want you to come down to my office every morning during the week. And I want you to put on that three-piece suit you have. And you report to my office and I'm going to give you $8. $8 a day. And I want you to take that $8 and go outside and get on the 83 bus that runs up Wilshire Boulevard. And when you get on the bus, ask the driver for a handful of transfers so you can get off periodically. Because every time you pass a hospital or a medical practice, I want you to get off the bus, go inside, talk to the administrator, and tell them that you're sober and free from chemicals for over 2 years in AA. And you need help getting your medical license back and you need a job. And at the end of the day, you're going to end up on the west side of town by the San Fernando Valley and West Los Angeles. And I want you to go to one of the Pacific Group meetings at night. And then I want you to take the bus back down here to the mission where you live. And by the way, don't have anybody drive you back down here. You take the bus. Because they have jobs. They have to get up in the morning. You are a loser. Kind man. Kind man. And I'm here to tell you that I lived in the Midnight Mission on Skid Row in Los Angeles for 8 months. And every weekday I went down and I got that $8. And I did what this guy said. You want to know why I did what he said? Because I was desperate. And I didn't have a better idea. And I got that $8. And I went outside and I got on that bus and I rode up Wilshire Boulevard. And in that 8 month period, I was into every hospital or medical facility between downtown LA and the San Fernando Valley 5 times. Because every time I'd make the rounds, I'd say, I've hit them all. They're not going to hire me. He'd say, go out tomorrow, get on the bus. Do it again. And I didn't have a better idea because I was desperate. And if you're new here tonight, my wish for you is not love. You're going to get a lot of that. Everyone's going to tell you how they love you here. And sometimes I go to meetings and it makes me ill. All we do is surround newcomers and hug them and say, don't worry, dear. You're here now. We love you. You're going to be all right. Well, you may not be all right. Because love is not the ingredient here. We have been loved all of our lives, most of us. If love was the answer to alcoholism, I would not be here. I was loved by family, wives, girlfriends, people, all my life. What got me here is desperation. And if you're new tonight, my wish for you is that you are desperate. Because if you are desperate, you are willing to do things you do not believe in. And so I rode the bus day after day after day. And one day in June of 1975, a Friday morning, I took my $8, went outside and got on that bus. And the first thing I did is I sat down in a huge wad of chewing gum. And I got it all over the back of my trousers. And I got off the bus midway up Wilshire and I went into a service station in the men's room. I tried to clean the gum off with wet paper towels. And it went all down the legs. I don't know if you ever tried that with chewing gum. It does not work. And I had about $10 left and I rode to the end of the line to a cafeteria in the old mall in Santa Monica. And I went in and I got a tray and I went through the line, the cafeteria line. I got some food. I set it down at the table, went outside to get a newspaper, and the busboy came in and took my lunch. You know what I mean? Bust the tray off the table. And I had, I don't know how much money left, enough to walk over to the Westwood Village in West Los Angeles by the UCLA campus. And I thought, if I go to a movie, I won't drink. That's all I have with me today, is maybe if I sit in a movie, I won't get drunk. That's the best I can do. And I went over to the Bruin Theater by the UCLA campus, and I stood in line to buy a ticket. And while I was standing in that line, I heard somebody call my name. And I turned around, and it was the administrator of the medical center in which I had been arrested in for stealing narcotics. And he said, Vince, where have you been? We thought you were dead or in an institution. And I said, I'm in AA, Norm. And I haven't had drank or used any chemicals in 2.5 years, 2 years and 8 months. And he said, you look terrific. And he says, your eyes are clear and you look just wonderful. And he was so profoundly moved, he started to cry. He put his arms around me. He was so glad to see me. And he said, when have you worked last? And I said, not in a long time. He said, that's remarkable. Because we have a urologist who's just joined our group practice. And he's a member of the Medical Quality Assurance Board in the state of California. And he's going to be down in the clinic tomorrow. I want you to come down. I'm going to introduce you to him. We're going to have lunch. Maybe he can help you get your license back. And if he can, how would you like a job back in that same emergency room? I went down the next day. I met with that urologist. We had lunch. He wrote some letters. Within 60 days, my medical license was restored in the state of California. I went back to work in the very same emergency room. And I'd like you to know, no drugs were missing for the following 2.5 years. And the patients received good care. I know. I gave it to them. I took these steps, 1 through 12. Just like they're written. I wrote that inventory that if you're new, you're trying to avoid. And I'm going to tell you, you can't avoid it. You must write it. And what you should know about that inventory is what we want from you are your secrets. That's what we want. It is not a psychotherapeutic exercise designed to get you in touch with yourself. We don't care about that. We want you to write your secrets down. The garbage. The things you're never going to tell anybody. That's what you write in the inventory. And don't waste the whole pad of paper telling us how wonderful you are because you're writing a moral inventory. Forget that. Put the bad stuff down. Then you have written an inventory. And I wrote that inventory. And I took it with this crazy sponsor who I didn't like. I read it to him one night under the dashboard of his car. He was making a talk out in the desert, and I read that inventory. And he told me how to go home and how to get into the 12 and 12 and get on my knees and take the 6th and the 7th step. And I did. And I made a list of the people I hurt, and I started to pay it back. And I began to help people. I became a member of my group and a member of my community. I became, for the first time in my life, a citizen. And my life has flourished. And that is not to say that I have not made mistakes, because I've made every mistake in sobriety that you can make. And I'm here to tell you the great news of AA. If you're new, you will never get drunk from making a mistake. Mistakes don't get you drunk here, only if you insist on defending them. But you'll never get drunk from making them. I have made all of them. All of them you can make. In August of 1976, I met a cute little redhead. We met in August, got married in September, and divorced in October. And the last time I saw her, she was on the way back to her daddy's ranch in El Dorado, Texas. But I'll tell you what. I did not drink and I did not run. I stayed here and I let it all hang out and I let you see it all. And as a result, I stayed sober. And my life flourished. And I'm married to a gal today who is... on Monday, we'll be 14 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we've been married for 9 years. And that's amazing because I don't know how to be married for 9 years. I don't know how to do anything, let alone be in a relationship with the same woman for 9 years. That's impossible. I can't do that. But I've done it. And I've done it because this woman has taught me so much about relationships. She has taught me a remarkable thing if you're new. You may want to know this if you're male and you're new. I have great news for you. You know what that is? Women are not the enemy. Isn't that a great thing to know? I'll tell you, it really is. And we love each other. I love her more every day. I love her with every breath I take. But not only love it do I love her, but I like her. And I wonder whether that isn't more important. Because we like each other. And we walk this way together. And we have a great life. And I'm in a new profession today, one I never thought I would be in. But I'm very successful. I make a lot of money. I own a big house in Pasadena, and I drive a Mercedes. And sometimes I pull it into AA meetings, and I see a beat-up old Chevy. I put my car on the other side of the lot, you know. I know he doesn't have insurance, for sure. So my relationship with that sponsor is wonderful. I love him very much. We've been together a long time. And he's having a bad time right now. He's got a bad time with his voice, and his wife is very ill. She had surgery on Thursday, and she had a lung collapse after having a quadruple bypass, and she's in intensive care. And it's not easy for him right now, so I'm going to pray for him tonight, and I hope you do too. He's a good guy. He's a good guy. He's all right, I'll tell you. And I love him, and I want good things for him. And my life is great too. It couldn't get any better. When I go into that office, I have an office on Wilshire Boulevard with a big picture window that overlooks Wilshire, as a matter of fact. And on days when I think I'm not getting what I deserve, I just go to that window, boy. I look up Wilshire Boulevard and I see the 83 bus coming down the boulevard. I'll tell you, I got a hell of a deal. You know, every time I see that bus, what could possibly be wrong? You know? And all of that is why we're here. And if you're new, I'm going to sit down. But I just want to tell you, I want you to get straight while you're here. Because I think there's a lot of confusion today about how you got here. You are not here because of psychotherapy or any psychiatric innovation. This has nothing to do with therapy. The collective wisdom of every shrink in the universe couldn't come up with this. Let me tell you, it is way beyond them. You're here because a stockbroker, beat up, defeated old stockbroker, stood in a hotel lobby in 1935 in the spring and was all out of gas. He was sober for 6 months, and he didn't know why he stayed sober. His relative spiritual experience, he tried to help other drunks, and none of them got sober. He didn't know why the hell he had. He just blew the biggest business deal of his life, the one that would put him back together. It was over. And he didn't go into a cocktail lounge and have a drink. What would you do if you were him? Where would you go? He didn't have a sponsor to call. He didn't do that. He went to a church directory, and he started calling ministers and got in touch with a woman named Cyberling, who led him to a drunken doctor. And that's why we're here. I don't think that's an accident. I think it's a gift from God. Thank you for having me.